From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon, sitting in for Terry Gross. Documentary filmmakers Alan and Susan Raymond captured a family disintegrating before our eyes in the PBS series An American Family. Their film about a police precinct in the South Bronx was the inspiration for Hill Street Blues. On today's Fresh Air, interviews Terry recently recorded with the Raymonds about their new film, set in an inner-city elementary school, and with Deanna Burney, the principal of the school. Also, novelist Toni Morrison was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature today. We'll feature a conversation with Morrison recorded last year, just after her novel Jazz was published. And Stephen Schiff reviews Shortcuts, the new film from Robert Altman, based on the writings of Raymond Carver. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton outlined his military policy for Somalia today, telling the nation that he plans to double the American troop commitment there, but will bring them all home by March 31st. The president said he'll deploy 1,700 fresh Army troops to Somalia, equipped with more than 100 armored vehicles. He's also ordered 3,600 Marines to stand by offshore in case they're needed. The president rejected calls for the immediate withdrawal of American troops, saying that such a move would return Somalia to chaos and damage U.S. credibility with both allies and enemies. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin says that he did not reject a request for additional armored vehicles in Somalia made last month, but does say he didn't act on the request. NPR's Martha Raddatz has the story.
At the beginning of September, the commander of U.S. forces in Somalia requested heavily armored vehicles for the U.S. troops. The request made its way to then Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Colin Powell. Powell, according to a source close to him, asked Secretary Aspin on two different occasions and was turned down. Secretary Aspin late today issued a statement that said the request was conducted in both military and civilian staff in the context of an evolving policy in Somalia aimed at reducing American presence, not increasing it further. The request was not rejected, said Aspin, but no action was taken on it at that time. Beyond that, said the secretary, the ultimate responsibility for the safety of our troops is mine as Secretary of Defense. Aspin said he'd accept responsibility for the consequences of that decision. I'm Martha Raddatz in Washington.
Former Secretary of State Lawrence Eagleburger warned members of a House panel today about the dangers of withdrawing from Somalia too quickly. NPR's Carol Ann Clark Kelly reports.
Eagleburger, who was in favor of the original humanitarian mission in Somalia, says the time has come for the U.S. to leave. But he warned that too quick a pullout following the murder of Americans would have implications for future peacekeeping operations.
That reaction to the killing of these Americans is simply an invitation the next time to the pipsqueak, the future ID'd, that if you kill Americans, you'll get them out. We must be very careful not to give the next ID'd the impression that all he has to do is murder an American or Americans, and that leads to our withdrawal.
Eagleburger says the U.S. must be careful in the future not to let peacekeeping missions slide from one objective to another without realizing it and making the necessary changes on the ground. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost more than 15 points today to close at 3,583. This is NPR. Supporters of the military rulers in Haiti forced the virtual shutdown of the country's capital today by intimidating people to go along with a general strike. The shutdown was seen as a direct challenge to U.S. troops and Canadian police trainers who are in Haiti to help restructure the military and police forces. The demonstrators demanded the expulsion of U.N. envoy Dante Caputo, who helped negotiate the agreement for the return of ousted President Jean-Paul Aristide at the end of this month. In some areas, police and armed thugs fired shots in the streets and beat up merchants to force them to take part in the general strike. In Angola, the government has agreed to resume peace talks with the UNITA rebel movement in another attempt to end the country's renewed civil war. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
UNITA says it has accepted its defeat in Angola's democratic elections last fall, and the rebels say they have also agreed to a new round of peace talks based on a 1991 peace accord and agreements reached with the government 5 months ago. Following the rebel announcement, government officials informed Alioune Blondin Bey, the United Nations Special Representative to Angola, that they were ready for peace talks. Until this week, UNITA rebel leader Jonas Savimbi had previously refused to accept the election results or previous agreements with the government. Rebel forces restarted the country's civil war 10 months ago and have seized about 75% of Angola's territory. Last month, the United Nations imposed an oil and arms embargo against UNITA. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
The next government of Pakistan will apparently be determined by which of two rival leaders is able to pull together a ruling political coalition. Neither Benazir Bhutto, a liberal, nor conservative Nawaz Sharif won an absolute majority in the latest elections. Both are former prime ministers, and each is claiming victory. Diplomats said that whichever candidate wins is likely to be saddled with a weak government. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Chris Spurgeon. Terry Gross is out today, but we'll be hearing an interview she recorded last week. Alan and Susan Raymond are the kind of documentary filmmakers who spend months with the subjects of their films, cameras rolling the whole time. 20 years ago, they lived with the Loud family for 7 months to make the PBS documentary series An American Family. During the series, Mrs. Loud asked for a divorce, and their son Lance announced he was gay. More recently, the Raymonds have made films on police in the nation's highest crime precinct, the South Bronx. They profiled the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary, and they made a study of three families with schizophrenic children. Their new film, I'm a Promise, is the story of the Stanton School, an elementary school in North Philadelphia where 90% of the students live below the poverty line and 95% come from single-parent homes. Later in the program, we'll hear from Alan and Susan Raymond, but first Terry speaks with Deanna Burney, who was the principal of the Stanton School for 3 years. She quit during the filming of the documentary. Burney has worked in the Philadelphia School District for 24 years and is now the principal of a middle school. I'm a Promise will debut on HBO on Monday. Terry Gross asked Deanna Burney why she decided to let the Raymonds film at her school, knowing they would show the bad with the good.
Well, most times, anything that's been done in the educational field has been outside of the school, or it's been like a controlled interview. And here we were going to have a documentary made where people were actually going to see us walk the walk. There's lots of people that talk the talk, but that's separate, and I felt that that was a good opportunity for us to really showcase the talents and gifts of our children and of our teachers and of our staff and of our families and of our community.
Were there any times you asked them to shut off the camera because you wanted a private moment with somebody?
I did try to get some private moments. I remember at that graduation scene when I was crying. I didn't ask them to shut off the camera because I really didn't want to direct or be involved in what they saw. I can't get outside myself and see myself as a human being, and I felt, you know, through this I would be able to see myself.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think sometimes we think we know how we're coming off, mm-hmm. or we think we know what we're saying, and sometimes we don't, because you can't get outside yourself and observe yourself in action.
One of the things that's clear you tried to do at the school was to build the self-esteem of your students. And you'd have them recite, I'm talented, intelligent, and gifted. Does that help, do you think, reciting things like that?
Well, I didn't have them recite it. If I asked them what kinds of students they were, you know, they responded that way. I also had a little boy that, if you asked him his name, he would say Mr. Potentiality, because one day the gospel choir was practicing, and I put my arms around him and said, Johnny, what is it that makes Miss Burney love you so much? And he said, because I'm a whole bunch of potentiality. And we called him Mr. Potentiality. There was another little boy that we called Mr. President, and when he was in first grade, we'd ask him where he'd live when he was grown, and he'd say the White House. What are you going to have a lot of? Money? Who are you going to give it to? Miss Burney, what are you going to do with it? Give it to the kids. I think that it's important that children hear those words, you know, that they're not words for a select group of children. And I don't think that the words are enough. It's the whole belief and the practices that go behind it. It's all of the other things that go with it.
It's clear in the movie that when you had a kid who was acting up and sent to your office, you would try, on the one hand, to show how much you cared about that child, and on the other hand, to show them that their behavior, on the other hand, was really unacceptable. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you show those two things at the same time? Your love for the child, but your disapproval of what they just did.
Mm-hmm. I think that all of us make mistakes in life, and children make mistakes just as well as I do. And I think that it's important that you put a reflective process in, that the child realizes that they made a mistake and what could they have done in the future, and at the same time set the expectations that you know that they can achieve, because lots of times I think our expectations are too low for our children. Our children want to learn, they want to do well, they want to succeed.
There was there's a couple of parents' meetings between you and one of the parents in the movie, and in one of the meetings, a child who you're obviously really close to has been acting up, and you say, listen, you know, if you don't leave my office now, I'm going to have to call in your mother. Finally, the mother comes in, and you sit down with the mother, and I think you're hoping that the mother is going to say something to her son like, this behavior is unacceptable. You must do what the principal says. You must do what the teacher says. And instead, the parent acts very inappropriately. I'm going to play a clip from the film.
Jakeena, I know that you're upset. Okay, and I don't want you to be upset this way. But what I want you to do is tell him that you and I are together on this, and he's supposed to listen, he's supposed to do his work, and that if he doesn't, you know, we can walk him home and you'll be there waiting for him.
You're going to make me hurt you. I'm not telling him nothing because I went through this last year with you. Matter of fact, you're going home. I'm going to show you. I'm not going to tell you anything. Let's go. And I'm going to punch you in your face, okay? Because I told you I'm not going through this year up here.
Chicken.
Go get your jacket now. You want to show up? Fool, can you get up? I'm tired of you with that dumb stuff.
What was your reaction when the mother threatened to hit the kid instead of, you know, verbally telling them that they've got to behave better?
Ask the mother not to hit the child, but accept the fact that the mother's really angry at the child and that the child has disappointed her. But at the same time, help her deal with that in other ways other than hitting the child.
How did you feel about that meeting with the mother being on camera?
Cornelius's mother, Jakeena, is very special to me. She was all of 24 years old. She had three children, and I saw her and watched her on a day-to-day basis nurture her own mother, who was very sick and eventually died. It didn't bother me being on camera with Jakeena.
You know, recently on this program, we had on Madeline Cartwright, mm-hmm. who was the principal of a school very close to the school
yes.
where you were a principal. And she was talking about how the way she made her school work, she brought in a washing machine and dryer. So if the parents didn't have time to wash the kids' clothes, someone at the school could take care of it, and the kids would know that they'd always be clean. She would sometimes bring children home with her and take care of them at her home for a night. She would organize the parents to clean the school. Did you end up doing things like that, too, in your school? Has that become part of what a principal needs to do nowadays?
Well, I think schools have been asked to address a lot of the social needs of the families, because it's the one place that still exists in the neighborhood. It's the first, it's a safe refuge, it's the closest refuge. I think in lots of ways that's unfortunate, because I feel as a principal accountable for performance and results, and we exist to teach children, and they're capable. And right now we have a lot of children in our schools who are underachievers, not low achievers. They're children who have learned how to be helpless, because they haven't gotten the instruction that they need. And that was something that I always had to try to balance and deal with in my day-to-day life.
So tell me about some of the things that you did that wouldn't really be in your job description as principal.
Well, first of all, probably the hours of the day, you know, getting there and opening up the school in the morning. I had a coal heat at school. And during the course of the 3 years that I was there, there's two people who were building engineers. They're the heads of the custodial team, and they're no longer employed by the school district because there were problems. The problems that you deal with day to day are things like dealing with maintenance. The 1201 people do not come under the administration of the principal.
Is the union you're talking about?
Yeah. So it's really a challenge to keep your building clean
and
immaculate and heated for the children and for the teachers. You know, there's no doubt in anybody's mind that schools exist for kids. But if you don't create the same conditions for the adults who serve the kids, you have a problem.
Did you end up doing cleaning yourself?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
What kind of cleaning would you do?
In the 3 years that I was there, I think there might have been three Saturdays and four Sundays that I wasn't in the building. And the community helped. They would send me breakfast on Sunday mornings. They would ask me how I wanted my eggs. One day a weekend, either a Saturday or a Sunday, I did cleaning. And I had a wonderful assistant to the building engineer, Theodora Guignard, and she used to help me put up bulletin boards. I spent every New Year's Day in that school with my family and with some people from the community who came, because we would try to do the bulletin boards over again and make things really beautiful for the staff and the children. And we paint it inside, we paint it outside. We did whatever it took. Our bathrooms had wall-to-wall mirrors in them. Lots of people ask, how can you tell if a school's a good school? I always say, visit the children's bathrooms. It undergirds everything that happens in the school. It shows how the adults respect the children and how the children respect the school. And our bathrooms were painted with the wall-to-wall mirrors, and there was always lots of things that you need, toilet paper, soap, paper towels, things like that.
Is it appropriate that principals should have to take on this kind of burden of cleaning and worrying about the heating system and redesigning the bathrooms? And I mean, it's just dealing with your basic administrative problems and discipline problems and knowing who the students are and being encouraging to them. That's mm-hmm. more than a full-time job right there.
Well, that's really what made me leave after the end of the third year, because I questioned myself all along about this. But there's a more important issue, and that is, by doing these things, I, as the educational leader of the school, wasn't really able to hone the instructional program and to make sure that children were learning, that they weren't underachievers.
But this is the dilemma, isn't it? Because if you don't take care of a school that looks decent, where the building has some dignity so the children can have some self-respect when they're in the building and they can be comfortable, and there's an atmosphere of respect in the school and safety in the school. If you don't have that, it's just pointless to try the lesson plans anyways, right?
You need that, but by only doing that, you reinforce society's bedrock belief that minority kids can't succeed mm-hmm. or that they're born with inferior intelligence. And I think that the time has come when people need to speak up about what they need to have a school that produces children that achieve, because the children are capable and the parents are supportive. And it's up to us to start to articulate what it is that needs to happen.
So you felt that you there just wasn't time to do both, to have a school that was physically tolerable and also to have a school where the curriculum was carefully designed.
Well, I asked for an assistant, and I wanted that assistant to just take care of the building concerns, the heat, the maintenance, making mm-hmm. sure that the bathrooms were clean. I had 720 students. The system was not able to respond and give me an assistant. And you have to have faith. You have to be able to hold your teachers up. The teachers there at that school were wonderful, and they did a yeoman's job. But in order to keep that going, I needed to really begin to focus in on instruction, and I took a stand. I asked the system to give me an administrative assistant, and or I wouldn't be back. The answer was no. So since I made that stand, as painful as it was, I had to stand by it.
Were you expecting that no for an answer?
I was expecting a yes, because I thought in the 3 years that we were there together, the children did make some, not a lot, academic progress. The parents in the community were involved. The churches gave us a lot of support. And I felt that we could have done so much more if I had just been able to get someone to take care of that building. I didn't mind washing windows, but I wasn't going to do them every day at the expense of the children's academic achievements. And then I expected a yes. And then I thought, well, maybe the parents will all rally, or maybe the teachers will all rally, and they'll have this great big rally, we want her back. And that didn't materialize. And so I had to stick by my conviction on what I said, that I wouldn't be able to go back unless I had an assistant.
Were you heartbroken? Did you really want to stay?
Yeah, I really wanted to stay.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And my guest is Deanna Burney, the former principal of a school, an elementary school in North Philadelphia. That school is the subject of a new documentary film called I Am a Promise, the story of children growing up outside the American dream. It's a film by Alan and Susan Raymond that debuts on HBO on October 11th. We'll meet the Raymonds after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Alan and Susan Raymond. Their new film, I Am a Promise, is a documentary about life in an elementary school in Philadelphia's inner city. The Raymonds are acclaimed documentary filmmakers whose other movies include An American Family, The Police Tapes, To Die for Ireland, and Elvis 56. They're joining us from the NPR Bureau in New York. Alan and Susan Raymond, welcome to
Hello.
Fresh Air.
Hi.
Why did you choose the school that we've been talking about and the school in which Deanna Bruni was principal as the subject for your movie?
I've said and continue to say that I think you could make this documentary in any inner-city elementary school in any large city in the United States. I think that the difference between Stanton, however, in any school, is the fact that Deanna was the principal when we, you know, went to survey it, and she seemed to have a kind of grasp of what we were after, almost an intuitive grasp, and allowed us the access that we really needed, because we don't work in a formal way. Our filmmaking technique is what's referred to as cinema verite, which basically is the belief in filming things kind of as they're happening spontaneously rather than, you know, formally conducting interviews and just shooting kind of, you know, cutaways. I mean, we like to spend time in a location and allow the story to kind of unfold naturally.
What are your ground rules when you're shooting somebody in your cinema verite style? What do you tell them about what's on the record and what's off the record? Do you give them the right to say, please turn off the camera now, this is a very private moment that I don't want to share with viewers of this movie?
No.
Well, Alan says no under no condition, and I say, oh, yes, and therefore we talk about it and see what the situation is. We never had that with Deanna Bruni. I mean, you would think that perhaps the situation where Jacquina is angry with her son, she would have turned to us, but she didn't. And I'm always amazed how things unfold sometimes myself. But if they have a problem, they obviously have the right to speak to us and ask us to stop, and then we discuss
it. Yeah, I mean, I don't think you want to bully people into being the subjects of your documentaries or force them to appear in sequences that are otherwise scenes that they would prefer not to appear in.
You worked on one of the most controversial documentaries, The Loud Family. It's called An American Family. It was a series of 12-hour-long programs that were shown on public television documenting the lives of one family over, I believe it was, a 7-month period. And the family went through a lot of turbulence through that period. The wife in the family, Pat Loud, asked for a divorce on camera. Were there lessons that you learned from that movie about how far you were comfortable going?
The lesson I learned that I kept with me my film career was that when you make a film about a person, an individual, not a police chief, not an institution, not the Army or the Bureau of Prisons, but when you make a film about an individual, you put it on television, you are really going to affect their lives very deeply. And you have, and I'm only speaking for myself, I'm not speaking for Alan. I feel you have a responsibility to take care of them during the next stage of the experience, which is when the press sees the film and the press makes critiques and things like that. Because I felt that at that time, Channel 13 or NET just threw the Louds out on the ice. And they were totally criticized and torn apart by the media, and I felt that they could have had a little more support at that time.
I feel
that way about the children of the school and Deanna Bruni and the parents in this neighborhood, that they might be reading television critics' remarks about their neighborhood that's going to be unpleasant, and that they just have to judge the work on what is in the 90 minutes.
Let me ask you about your film, The Police Tapes, and this was shot, I believe, in 1976 at a police precinct in the South Bronx, and it's said to be the inspiration for Hill Street Blues. What's the connection between the two?
Stephen Bochco saw our film and decided to model it for his next, you know, television series, and at that point his career wasn't very established, and he took He literally took many scenes. He copied the photography. He copied the character, the sergeant that talks at roll call, be careful out on the streets. Or
yeah, your movie opens with the roll call, just like Hill Street Blues.
No, our movie, his Hill Street Blues opens like police tapes.
That's what I mean.
Yeah,
right.
And he took many characters from our film.
He said this publicly in interviews in books and Rolling Stone, American Film, et cetera. I mean, this is not something that we're guessing. I mean, he's admitted that he saw our film and said, if I could make a TV series that had that immediacy and that raw reality and, using handheld camera and kind of, jittery sort of scenes that would convey the intimacy and the reality of the streets, that I would be happy. And I guess he had a good film. We had a good film, what can I say? Often documentaries do influence dramatic filmmaking. I mean, this is not something new. This has happened quite a bit.
But it also influenced journalism, because that was the mid-70s, and that was coming off of the 60s, and the cops or the police and journalists didn't speak because it was the old legacy of calling them pigs and things like that. And we did the point of view from the backseat of the squad car, and from that time on, you will see, if you actually chronicle it, more news footage of policemen's activities that's similar to ours, because the police liked our film, and then they started to open up and trust other journalists. And I think now that you have these programs like 911 and Cops, it's all part of...
I also might say I think these films have now gone too far in the direction of giving the police a voice. I think that the point of view in Cops, to me, is a very questionable one. I think that it venerates police. It usually shows their activities with a kind of a heroic portrait. And I actually think that these shows actually are a far cry from Police Tapes. I think Police Tapes was a much more objective show that really explored the darker side of policing than these shows do, although these shows are kind of derivative from what we originally did. But I don't like to compare them. I think ours is a more serious work of journalism than these shows are.
Were there any scenes either in the Police Tapes or in other documentaries that you shot where you had to choose between your safety and getting the scene that you wanted?
No, we're totally foolish. I remember in Police Tapes, you had mentioned there was a scene of them knocking the door down. There was a man holding his mother hostage, and the SWAT team had come to knock the door down, and the irony was that they couldn't get it down.
Yeah, I had mentioned the scene to you before the interview started. I liked it so much because they have this battering ram, and they're trying to knock down the door. And, after they go at it for a couple of minutes, they're all out of breath. They have to pause a little bit, then start all over again.
Right.
And, it's not exactly some cop coming in and kicking in the door like we always see on TV. Anyways, you were saying.
Well, it brought back the memory of making that at that moment, because we had arrived on the scene. We were the first news crew on the scene because the cops had given us the tip. So we got behind the lines before anybody else, and Alan kept saying, "You got to get in there. You got to get that sound." And I kept, inching my way forward. And then all of a sudden, I stood there and realized I was in the front line. That I was standing next to guys in flak jackets with semi-automatic rifles that were cocked, and that if the door opened, I was going to be the first one that was going to get hit. Now, what was I doing there just to get good sound? Unfortunately, it turned out otherwise. But I had a moment there when I realized, what was I doing here?
Susan and Alan Raymond speaking with Terry Gross. The Raymonds' new documentary about Deanna Burney and the Stanton School, I Am a Promise, will be shown on HBO throughout October. It debuts on Monday. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Today, Toni Morrison was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature and credited by the Swedish Academy for writing novels with visionary force and poetic import. Coming up, we feature an interview recorded with Morrison after the publication of her most recent novel, Jazz. And there's a new movie from Robert Altman based on the writings of Raymond Carver. It's called Shortcuts. Our film critic Stephen Schiff has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton says that he is sending more U.S. troops to Somalia, but he also announced a pullout date of March 31st. In a speech to the nation late this afternoon, Mr. Clinton said that 1,700 more ground troops will be sent to Somalia, with 3,600 Marines and sailors offshore. Mr. Clinton said before U.S. troops leave, they will provide protection for U.S. operations there, keep roads open so that food and supplies can get through, and make it possible for the people of Somalia to reach agreement in order to solve their own problems.
It is my judgment and that of my military advisors that we may need up to 6 months to complete these steps and to conduct an orderly withdrawal. We'll do what we can to complete the mission before then. All American troops will be out of Somalia no later than March the 31st, except for a few hundred support personnel in non-combat roles.
Mr. Clinton said that the U.S. mission to Somalia was started for the right reason and must be finished in the right way. President Clinton's plans are backed by Senate Republican leader Robert Dole. Dole says that he hopes the president will get broad bipartisan support, and his only objection is a deadline for getting out.
The important thing is the mission, not the date. In fact, that's the one thing I wouldn't have done if I'd been the president, put in a March date. Except, he said, for a few hundred people. Who knows what it's going to be like in March? I think it'd been better to say not later than March unless authorized by Congress, because you might be able to bring them home more quickly, and if necessary, you'd have to come back to Congress in any event.
Dole says that he believes the president understands the importance of U.S. efforts in Somalia and of ending the operation there soon. In New York City, Bosnia's president made a plea today to the UN for international action to save his nation. NPR's Trevor Rowe has more on the story.
Izetbegovic said the current peace plan worked out during talks in Geneva was flawed, that the partition rewards the aggressor. He denounced international efforts in Bosnia so far as an experiment of political vivisection. He warned that the world's Muslims were watching to see how the UN responds to their brethren in the Balkans.
At least 1 billion people are waiting for this body to act. Are you really ready to surrender Bosnia and its people to annihilation? This billion of people that I have mentioned, and not only they, will never forgive you.
Izetbegovic called on the UN Security Council to enforce its own resolutions and ensure a viable peace in Bosnia. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down more than 15 points to close at 3,583.63 on volume of more than 255 million shares. This is NPR News. In Moscow, Russian President Boris Yeltsin has suspended Russia's highest court, charging that it had helped push the nation to the edge of civil war. The court has sided with hardline opponents of Yeltsin. In a speech yesterday, the Russian leader said that the court shared some of the blame for the recent violence in Moscow because it became involved in politics. The Russian leader now says that the court will meet only after new elections to parliament are held in December and a new post-Soviet constitution is approved. Officials of the Clinton administration and environmental groups have reached an agreement that could lead to resumption of limited logging on federal lands in the Pacific Northwest. But the timber industry does not like this plan. NPR's John Nielsen reports.
New logging on federal lands in the Pacific Northwest has been frozen since 1992, when environmental groups sued the government for failing to protect the old-growth forests needed by endangered animals like the northern spotted owl. But today, these same environmental groups said they'd go along with a White House plan to get the freeze lifted on 2,000 acres worth of northwestern old-growth forest. In return, the White House said it would fight congressional attempts to exempt Northwestern loggers from environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act. A spokesman for the timber industry ridiculed the proposal, saying it would do little to revive the logging economy. If the deal is approved by a federal judge, new logging could start by the end of the year. I'm John Nielsen in Washington.
In New York City, members of the UN General Assembly are set to lift all economic sanctions against South Africa and will soon end an oil embargo. Last month, African National Congress leader Nelson Mandela urged the UN General Assembly to lift sanctions and encourage other nations to invest in South Africa. Mandela said that steps to a multi-party democracy in South Africa are well underway. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Today, American writer Toni Morrison was awarded the 1993 Nobel Prize in Literature. The Swedish Academy praised Morrison for writing novels that show epic power, unerring ear for dialogue, and richly expressive depictions of Black America. Terry Gross spoke with Toni Morrison last year when her sixth novel, Jazz, was published. It was her first new novel since Beloved, which won a Pulitzer Prize in 1988. Jazz is about African Americans who move from the rural South to the urban North. It's set in Harlem in 1926. Terry talked to Toni Morrison about her own family's migration.
You have this sense in your novel, Jazz, of people coming to Harlem or coming to the city and feeling more like themselves there, more like the people they always believed they were, is the way you put it. That's obviously something you were really interested in developing in the story, just what it meant physically and emotionally for people to move to the city. You must have stories about that in your family history.
Oh, I do, yes. That move from the rural areas where I think in literature sometimes we romanticize into the freedom of the countryside, you know, the sort of ability to commune with nature and be one's transcendent self. And there is that mythos in literature. And there's an accompanying one, which is the freedom of a city. On the one hand, there's a certain kind of anonymity, but more particularly for and especially for African Americans, it was moving into an area where there were so many of you. You could see yourself in your number, and there was a certain kind of protection in that, as well as some license. Also, it was, I don't know, the idea of a city as being a place where there is a mix, where there are many classes, many kinds of people, and however eccentric you are, there are, you know, at least 100 other people who are eccentric in precisely the same way, so that one has solitude, solitariness, individuality, and community in a city. And I think that, you know, impelled and compelled African Americans as it did immigrants. There was a risk there, but there was enormous opportunity, and there was some safety.
Would you share with us one of your parents' migration stories?
Yes, I think one of the ones that I remember best was when my mother's parents left the South, left Alabama. My grandmother's husband, my grandfather, had gone to a large city to earn some money playing the violin, as a matter of fact, and she was alone on their farm with these children who were very, very young. I think my mother was 5. And there was some danger about. It was the time when a woman alone with several children was a kind of a target. And her words were that when she noticed white boys beginning to circle that house, she had to leave immediately. So she sent word to her husband, to my grandfather, by somebody who was en route to tell him that she would be on X train at X time. And that if he wanted to see them again, he should be there. And so they left in the middle of the night. In the middle of the night, because there's always debt in that sort of sharecropping situation that most post-Reconstruction Black people found themselves in. And went to Birmingham and got on the train. And as the train pulled out, there was no Papa. And the children all began to wail and cry. And a few miles outside the city, he appeared, but he hadn't felt that he could show himself at the station and get on with them because they were escaping that cycle of debt, you know, that round that you can never really escape because, you know, the commissary of the general store you need for the feed and that takes the crops, etc. So it was a happy event for them. And then the subsequent stops on that route to where they were headed, looking for work for mines that were asking for laborers, for mills, for women who could work in service, is an interesting and very typical story. And they ended up on the shores of Lake Erie, where I was born.
In Ohio?
Yes.
What was Lorraine like when you were growing up? What kind of neighborhood were you growing up in?
It was an interesting place. I still think it's remarkable. In that part of Ohio, and I think in a large, in many of those states, I never lived in a black neighborhood because what we were living in were really just poor neighborhoods. So that I grew up with all of the other immigrants who were coming to this country. I'm thinking as I speak to you now of the house where my mother lives at this moment, and the people on the street are named Tershak and Galini and my mother and a black woman named Mrs. Ross and so on. That's always been the case in that town because it was a steel town. And people were coming from Mexico, from Eastern Europe, from Scandinavia, from everywhere, as well as black people coming to these centers just after World War I and in some instances before in order to find work. So we had a kind of town that was, I don't know, all the ideals that are probably purely rhetorical existed in that little town. However, everybody, whether they were Polish people or what they used to call Slovenes in those days, had their own halls, churches, and, you know, family life. That was not mixed. You know, you didn't exchange on those areas in those days. But there's one high school, four junior high schools, and we all went to the same school.
So what was the African-American cultural center? Was it the church or was it something else? The church?
Absolutely, the church.
And you'd go every Sunday? Beyond Sunday?
Well, they had a very, you know, complicated social life.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it was Sunday, part of it was Sunday school, but a lot of it was taking care of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And what I remember most is the impetus and the necessity for my mother and her friends and for all of us to take food to people who needed it or to go clean somebody's house if they were bedridden. All sorts of chores were taken for granted. When people got old, they didn't have any place for them to go. And if their families were indigent or couldn't take care of them, that was the responsibility of the women of the church or of the neighborhood. It was just a constant part of one's life. I think in The Bluest Eye, I recorded something similar that really happened, which is my sister and I would sleep in the same bed and we might wake up and there might be a child next to us, somebody who was in difficulty or the parent was sick or gone, and women in the neighborhood would take them in. And there might be some children living with us for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks or months or what have you. And we were not, you know, it was a kind of violation of what everybody seems to think is important now, which is intimacy and privacy. And, of course, as a young girl, I wanted to leave it. But at the same time, it was a kind of sharing of other, you know, of responsibilities, social responsibilities. No one ever talked about it and said, you know, you ought to be a responsible member of the society. But everything people did was like that.
Well, it would seem to me that in your adult life as a single mother, writer, and editor, that you would have had precious little time to devote to the community. I mean, because you had to be so busy with bringing up your own children and, you know, earning a living and writing and so on.
It's true. I had precious little time. I didn't think of it that way because I understood my work to be very much bound up with service to the community. But what I missed, I'll have to tell you, was the community service to me. You know, I understood that if I lived in Lorain, Ohio, and I was working and I had small children, I wouldn't have to get a babysitter.
Mm-hmm.
somebody would do that and ask me, did I need help? Or, you know, those kinds of things on the block or on the street were people who watched your children because they took that as part of what being an adult was like.
Terry Gross is talking with writer Toni Morrison, who just won the Nobel Prize in Literature. Terry recorded this interview last year when Morrison's novel Jazz and her book on literary criticism, Playing in the Dark, had just been published. We'll be back with more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with Terry's interview with writer Toni Morrison.
In your new book of literary criticism, Playing in the Dark, you write about how until recently American readers were assumed to be white, and you wonder what that assumption has meant to the literary imagination in America. Were you, when you started reading, were you conscious of reading books in which there were few, if any, black characters?
No, I was conscious of there being a sort of disruption in some books when black people did occur.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a kind of embarrassment, a kind of a need to skip over those parts in, say, being in the 10th grade and reading Uncle Tom's Cabin, or seeing children's books in which, was it Sambo? I mean, you know, these kinds of things. And you sort of politely erase them from your consciousness until you get older. And then when I became a writer, I had to function in a language that was coded in a number of ways. And I had to work with those codes. I didn't have access to some of the metaphors and shortcuts that, say, a white writer has who feels he or she is unraced, and they can take for granted the centrality of their experience because it is white, and they think that's being without a race. Everybody else has race. White people don't. They could take for granted that kind of centrality, and they could use cleverly, brilliantly, effectively or not, as the case might be, the presence of black people, just as they frequently did the presence of women. It's sort of something you have in your kit.
So when you say that the language was coded, let me get you to elaborate on the kind of code you felt you had to cut through or work around.
Well, calling slaves slaves instead of laborers or workers is one code. Using black women and men to appear in a scene for no reason other than to provide the tension that might suggest illegal sexuality
mm-hmm.
or violence. They have no other function except to define and to suggest to be the association of. And you wonder, why are they there? And they may never be picked up again. But they have this impact. To have classical American literature to need to establish virtue, power, and dominance over something, and to need an obedient black person or someone who loves you irrationally. Mark Twain's Jim is irrational in that sense. His love is boundless, and he's a grown man talking to children. I could not do that, say, with a white man who was an ex-convict.
I think it's fair to say that in most of your fiction, there's really been very few significant white characters.
Well, yes.
Yeah, so how does that relate to what you're talking about now, about the code and...
Oh, well, in a sense, having, it would be silly for me to write or to concentrate on major white characters. because I wasn't interested in it, and also it destabilizes the progress of the narrative in a way. For example, putting a young black girl center stage seemed to me a radical thing to do in 1965 when I first began writing The Bluest Eye. Once you begin to permit the reins of the narrative to be held by a major white person, and you lose the terrain, the imaginative terrain, because you may be forced into responding to a white presence instead of examining what the interior lives of these people are without the constant need to explain, to editorialize, and to fix. So it was an enormous liberation for me, and one that I find to be repeated a lot, particularly in the work of black women. Once you take those people out, then it's as though the whole world is available now for one's own creativity. But in a sense, it's all a little bit more real than that. White people were not central to my life. They were out there, sort of on the edge, sometimes wonderful and enabling, sometimes hostile and disabling. But the heart of the life, even in the town that I described, was in our household, in our family. So that in the novels, I wanted to, in that sense, not have characters who were always required to do what I don't think we were required to do, is to consistently think about what white people were thinking. It makes you reduce them in some sort of stereotypical way that I would shy away from. But certainly I was interested and fascinated by and sort of thrilled by a number of minor figures, that is secondary figures, enabling figures in who are white, such as Amy Denver in Beloved, who is not required to be a white person in that scene because she's not around any other white people. So she can go ahead and be a person. And also, she does something I think that almost never happens, if ever, in American fiction, which is to have a white person touch a black person with some motive other than sex or violence.
Toni Morrison, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Writer Toni Morrison. Terry recorded this interview after the publication of her books Jazz and Playing in the Dark. Today, Toni Morrison was awarded the 1993 Nobel Prize in Literature. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams joins us from National Public Radio in Washington with a preview of All Things Considered. Noah, Somalia leads the news again today.
Once again, Chris, yes, I'll talk with a former UN envoy to Somalia who says it's never been proven to the Somalis that General Mohamed Farah Aidid is indeed guilty of killing UN peacekeepers, and that needs to be settled as part of a new approach toward a settlement there. Also, I'll talk with John Burns of the New York Times in Sarajevo about local crime gangs taking over that city, working in collaboration with the Serb forces who have besieged Sarajevo. Maria Inahosa has an update on the New York City mayor's race, and it's Thursday in time for letters from listeners.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The success of last year's movie, The Player, made Robert Altman newly bankable in Hollywood. Bankable enough, in fact, to get his latest dream project made. Shortcuts is over 3 hours long, has 22 major characters, and is loosely based on 9 short stories by Raymond Carver. It opened the New York Film Festival last week, which is where film critic Stephen Schiff caught up with it.
First came the praise for this movie. People like Gore Vidal calling it the great American novel, which is a flashy but not a particularly illuminating thing to say. Then came the backlash. Critics complaining that Shortcuts isn't exuberant and unified like Nashville, and it isn't small-scaled and moody like Raymond Carver, all of which is true, but irrelevant. For me, it's not so important what Shortcuts isn't. What matters is what this movie is. In Shortcuts, Altman has gone beyond Nashville, and even beyond Carver, to create an enormous collage of mostly white, mostly lower middle class, mostly dysfunctional Los Angeles life. And though it's not a pretty picture, it is a powerful one. No doubt about it, the stories we're being told are downers. They're all about people who lie to each other, people who can't connect, people who drink and drift and betray. And yet the movie never feels heavy or cruel. Altman tells all these stories with his usual nimble wit and buoyant camera style, and even at its most sour-spirited, his tone is distanced and Olympian in a way that keeps the audience from sinking along with the characters. Like any great collagist, Altman always keeps his viewer aware of the whole canvas. What's interesting to him is not so much the individual bits and pieces as the connections between them. And the connections in this film are so deft and funny and magical that they keep thrilling you even after the movie's over. Some of the stories are stronger and some weaker. And in some, what really matters is the magnetism of the actors. Actors like Bruce Davison and Andy McDowell in the movie's best tale about a couple whose child is hit by a car. And actors like Jennifer Jason Leigh as a housewife who makes her living doing phone sex while she diapers the kids. Tim Robbins plays a strutting cop who philanders. And Madeline Stowe, who gets better with every movie, is his wife who takes a perverse pleasure in the audacity of his lies. In this scene, though, she has a comeback of her own. As she and Robbins get ready for bed, Stowe starts talking about her sister, a rising young painter.
Marion's got a crush on Alex Trebek.
Alex Trebek?
Yeah.
Where'd she meet him?
At a party. He's an art collector or something. She thinks he might buy one of her paintings.
Nah, I don't think so.
Well,
I don't see how she could even give those things away.
Well, she sells a lot more than you think. I posed for her today. Ralph walked in the middle of it.
Ralph? What a jerk. I don't know if I know a bigger jerk.
Well, it was embarrassing, but I guess they're used to it being doctors and artists.
What's
and all.
Embarrassing about it?
Well, you know. I was nude.
This isn't a perfect movie, the way Nashville and McCabe and Mrs. Miller and even The Player were. Some of the stories are excruciatingly banal, especially one with Annie Ross as a boozy lounge singer who can't communicate with her spacey cello-playing daughter, Laurie Singer. And some of the performances, especially by Matthew Modine and Lyle Lovett, are stiff and unconvincing. Shortcuts, hits and misses. But taken as a whole, it's almost unbelievably rich. A vivid portrait of a middle-class America in which surprising new connections are being forged, even as all the old ones disintegrate.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Bob Alls, Chris Fraley, Joyce Lieberman, Richard Parker, and Audrey Phoblitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. For Terry Gross, I'm Chris Spurgeon.
Funding for Fresh Air is provided by the National Endowment for the Arts and by the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies with 74 mutual fund portfolios offering comprehensive investment and retirement services. 1-800-643-3395. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This Saturday would have been John Lennon's 53rd birthday. On the next Fresh Air, we remember John Lennon with interviews from our archives with Yoko Ono and John's first wife, Cynthia Lennon. That's next time on Fresh Air.